You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
This episode of Monster Talk has an explicit tag because it talks frankly about human anatomy and about the South American fish that allegedly sometimes makes visits to that same anatomy. I know for a variety of reasons that there's going to be folk who don't want to hear about this because it makes them feel squeamish, but I hope if you can stomach it, you'll stick with us because it turns out there's a lot of lessons to be learned about humans as we examine the legends surrounding this fish. Thanks.
Monster Talk.
Hey, did you have a pee before we left, by the way?
No, I didn't. So I could have it if we get in the water, surely. It's big enough to accommodate my urine.
You mustn't pee in the river. That's the key thing. There's a fish here called a candiroo fish. Have you heard of that?
Oh, no, that's an urban myth, isn't it?
No, it's true. It's about this long.
Yeah.
And if you pee in the water, which I'm serious, you mustn't do,
yeah,
it swims up your urine and into your willy.
God.
It's apparently unbelievably painful, and you have two choices. You chop your willy off, or you have to get to a hospital, and given we're near a hospital here, there's only that first choice. I've got a couple of pieces of string, actually. So if you just tie a knot in it. So I've done mine, but which size do you need?
It's
actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Oh, I am so excited to finally get to cover this topic. I first learned about the vampiric catfish back in 2012, from what I can see in my email archive. That's also the year I bought a copy of Candiroo, Life and Legend of the Blood-Sucking Catfishes by Stephen Spott. He had done a lot of research into the fish, and back in 2002, he put out this book, which covers the fish and the very disturbing single case, which allegedly confirms the folklore about it. What lore is it that I'm speaking of? Well, let's go to a clip of the show River Monsters with Jeremy Wade. I'll also include a link to that clip and to the Candiroo book in the show notes if you want to check them out.
While he was relieving himself, suddenly he said, you know, he just had a bit of a shock. And, you know, the first thing he knew was that the fish was already, you know, inside. Only, you know, just the end of its tail was out. Tried to grab hold of it, but it's a very smooth fish, a bit like a bar of soap. No good, you know, no success pulling it out. So basically just ran up onto the bank to try and get some help.
A fish like this may have entered Silvio in search of a blood meal, but little did it know that its mistake would result in an unprecedented medical procedure lasting 2 hours.
The first thought was to, a bit like a hook that's got a barb on it, actually pulling it back the way it went in is not always a good idea. He was thinking of actually sort of coming in from the side, coming in from the perineum, and actually trying to sort of pull the fish out head first. But he thought that because, you know, it had been such a long time in there, they would actually, and also the other fish were starting to rot a bit, maybe try and pull it out with the endoscope, you know, out tail first, the way that it went in. The tail of the fish was about here, about an inch in, and so the head of it would have been somewhere like here. And then what happened was that the pincers were gradually, you know, manipulated out of the hole here. There we go. Grabbed hold of the fish just in front of the tail, and then the whole apparatus just gradually, very delicately moved out.
Thus confirming, after centuries of speculation, that a fish has entered a human in the most intimate of places.
So that clip seemed very compelling, especially when you watch the folks on screen. But there's more going on here than meets the eye, and to help us find out more, we'll be talking with ichthyologist Dr. Nathan Lujan. And hang on, because there's some big surprises in this show.
Monster Dog.
Tonight we're talking with Dr. Nathan Lujan, and he's the Associate Curator of Fishes at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. His work is an effort to improve fish species identification, to better understand freshwater ecosystems, and to figure out where fish are best placed in the wonderful taxonomic tree of life. And tonight, we're going to talk to Nathan about a real yet legendary fish, the vampiric catfish of the Amazon, with a reputation that may cause some of you to wither in sympathetic discomfort, the kandaroo. Welcome to Monster Talk, Dr. Lujan.
Hello. Glad to be with you.
We're so happy to have you here. We found you through Matthew Coleman, who we interviewed a few months ago. We talked with him about the piranha, and he said you were the go-to person for this topic. So we're very excited to have you on. And just to start, how did you get into fishes? How did you get into this topic?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, which is the epicenter of temperate freshwater diversity. And grew up exploring streams, loving the beautiful fishes in Middle Tennessee. And then an aquarium store opened up near my house, and I started keeping aquaria and falling in love with the fishes of the tropics. And had the opportunity in graduate school, really my first full year of a PhD program at Auburn University, to go to Venezuela. And went to the Upper Orinoco, an area where very few people had collected before, and found a lot of undescribed species. And that was really that was what really hooked me on the tropics, was the opportunity to discover new species, to describe new species, and to figure out their ecological relationships and their evolutionary relationships. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Hooked. I see what you did there. It's usually Blake.
This may be a thing. Yeah, this... He'll school us on these fishes.
If you talk to Coleman, you know what puns are all about. I mean,
that's right.
Oh yeah, the two of them.
We had a lot of fun. Well, so the kandaroo is it's in the catfish family. What distinguishes these kind of fish from other kind of fish besides the way they pair so nicely with hush puppies?
Well, catfishes are an incredibly diverse group. They're about 3,500 species. They're globally distributed. They're present on every continent, although there are no living catfishes on Antarctica. There is a catfish fossil from Antarctica. And that diversity has a geographical component to it. Or if you look at the very first, or the order of catfishes, is called Siluriformes. And if you look at the very first branch in the Siluriformes, in this the tree of all catfishes, you get a branch leading to a group of exclusively South American catfishes that includes the kandaroo. And this group is called the Loricarioidea, the suborder Loricarioidea. And that includes some other noteworthy catfishes, all of your plecos, your wood-eating catfishes, your naked suckermouth catfishes. A big group of South American catfishes that are pretty ubiquitous. They're widespread. They live in all different habitats, and they have a really wide range of anatomy. So the armored catfishes are these The plecos are things you're probably familiar with from the aquarium trade, but they are the algae eaters or the glass cleaners that have these bony plates on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cori cats, the little armored cori cats that are popular in the aquarium fish trade, are part of that group also. Well, the kangaroo is a trichomycteridae, and their common name is the pencil catfishes. And the majority of them, the majority of trichomycteridae are invertivores or insect feeders. They're not too unusual looking or behaving. They're again very widespread. But then there is a lineage of trichomycteridae that has evolved into this very parasitic niche, and that includes the blood feeders, the vandalines that are the kangaroo you're thinking of, and then there's another group called the stegophyllines that scrapes scales and slime coat from other fishes.
They all sound lovely.
Yeah.
So cool. We want to talk about the legend of these particular fish, because mm-hmm. after the introduction that we just gave, I expect that our listeners are going to want to find out more about them and what's going on here and sort out some of the fact from the folklore, because I had heard of this creature and heard some of the nasty stories that I'm sure we're going to get into, and heard that they were ultimately that was all myth and legend.
Yes, very unlikely, put it that way.
Okay. Show's over.
Oh, it's yeah. Well, what is the lore? I mean, like, what do people say happens?
Well, yeah. So there's a legend that it's really one particular genus, the genus Vandalia, that people are thinking about. That's a very elongate, slender catfish that has that shares with other members of the Trichomycteridae this presence of external teeth. So there are the teeth in the mouth. And then these catfishes have some teeth outside of the mouth around the head, and those are called odontodes. And these odontodes, they're on the opercular bone. So the bone that opens and closes on a sunfish or a panfish that you might be familiar with, that bone is really modified in these catfishes, and it has these teeth on the outside. And so when they open that operculum, those teeth flare out, and then there's another set of bones that get levered out that also have teeth. So they can flare these four clusters of teeth outside of their head and lodge themselves into tight cavities, basically. But their normal way of living is to go into the gill cavities of other fishes and then to use their oral teeth to open a hole in an artery and then to ingest blood, much like a leech. So they have this ability to attach, to ingest blood, and then a stomach that expands, much like a leech. And they gorge themselves on blood and then just fall off and digest that meal and continue on with their life cycle. So that's the typical way of life for one of these kangaroos, one of these Vandalia. Now, there's a legend that some of these occasionally find their way into human orifices, be it the male urethra, the female vagina, or an anus. This is a legend. And I've been a lot of places in South America, and I've talked to a lot of people who live around these things all the time, and never heard of any first-person accounts about these. And it's really hard to find anyone telling a first-person story about this happening. You know, when it does happen, it gets, a lot of press, a lot of attention, and there's really only one case in which this has been observed or purported to have happened, and even involved a doctor. So this is kind of an authoritative case, but there's a lot that we can talk about with regard to that case that maybe lends some doubt to whether it actually happened or not.
Yeah, maybe we should.
They sound nasty anyway, even if they don't do all of the things that people say they do.
They're not nasty at all. They're wonderful, beautiful creatures. You should look at, so I've got a lot of CT scans of the heads of these things. I kind of got into this indirectly because I wanted to understand the evolutionary diversification of a lot of these kinds of cranial modifications, these elements of the skull that are really bizarre features of this this group of catfishes, this big group of South American catfishes. And so to look at that better, I started putting them in a micro CT scanner. So I was a postdoc at the American Museum of Natural History for 2 years, and they have a micro CT scanner there that basically takes thousands of x-rays, and then a computer is able to assemble those two-dimensional x-rays into a three-dimensional digital model of the internal anatomy. And what I found when I started CT scanning these was one, just an amazing skull and a lot of really bizarre features of the skull. But then two, a lot of diversity across specimens that represented undescribed species. And so it turns out that this group is very poorly studied from a taxonomic perspective. And really only just a few weeks ago, there was a paper that came out that described nine new species of the genus Paracanthopoma, which is a close relative of Vandalia. So we're actively discovering and describing new species in this group, partly because of the ability to visualize that internal anatomy with CT scans. Many of these are very small fishes. So anyways, I was visualizing this internal anatomy, noticing all these skull bones. And then with that digital anatomy, I can then kind of model the evolution of this group and look at how many millions of years it's taken for these different groups to evolve.
Perhaps we could discuss this one documented case then that seems to have involved a kangaroo, but it allegedly also involved the swimming upstream of urine legend that we've all heard about. Yeah. So is it a 1997 incident involving a Silvio Barbosa?
Yes. Originally known as FBC. If you look at the Wikipedia report, at least the name is FBC, and then in the Jeremy Wade River Monsters, it has him on video, and he's now Silvio. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you could tell us about that story. I think a lot of our listeners will have heard of it already, but if you could just kind of give us an overview of what supposedly happened.
Allegedly, yeah.
Well, there have been a few accounts of this, and I'm not I have my doubts about the account, so I don't, I haven't studied them overly to know, you know, what the details are. But basically, this guy was supposedly standing thigh deep in the Amazon and urinating, and while he was urinating, one of these kangaroo came swimming up the urine stream. And in a split second was buried in his urethra, was deep into his urethra with only the tail exposed beyond his penis. And he tried to remove it with his fingers, but they slipped right off, and it was very slippery and was unable to remove it. So ended up in the care of a urologist, as you do when you have a catfish in your penis. And that urologist went in with a scope and
endoscope, I think.
Endoscope, yeah. Yes, an endoscope with a little pair of scissors and I guess clipped the spines on the catfish and removed the catfish from his urethra. And that catfish, I've actually held the jar with that catfish. It is now at the Brazilian Institute for Amazonian Research in Manaus, INPA. And it's in a jar of 70% ethanol and catalog.
30% urine. What? No.
Yeah. Oh, better urine than blood.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Oh my God. A lot of things about this. Okay, let me be clear. The man really did have a catfish in his penis. That's real. I think that's fairly safe to say.
I don't know that that's safe to say at all.
Oh, really? Okay. So even maybe that's not even safe to say. Fascinating. Okay. I was always concerned that, like, it sounded plausible when a doctor says he pulled it out and has video. But again, videos can be faked. And I just don't know. But I tell you, a lot of it does seem suspect. Like, how could a fish swim up a stream of urine? That to begin with seems entirely implausible.
That's the first implausible.
Yeah,
first part of the story is the first implausible aspect, and it doesn't get any better from there, really.
It doesn't. I mean, once you see a fish is trying to get in your penis, I don't care how slippery it is, I'm going to break its neck. I'm not going to go, my, this fish is slippery as it slides inside me against my will.
So yeah. What do we think really happened there then?
I can't even, you know, speculate. I will say that bizarre things happen in the Amazon and very lonely men on the river do bizarre things to their bodies. You know,
it's taking a turn.
Dear Lord, listeners, don't ever Google images of people putting things inside their penises.
Yes, do not Google.
Do not Google that. Do not Google that, because you will come up with images and you won't be able to unsee them.
So, you know, who knows what happened? Maybe it never happened. Maybe he caught one of these and thought it might be fun to, you know. Maybe he wanted the fame and fortune of being the victim of a kangaroo attack.
Oh yeah, I'm sure he had that.
That lucrative,
you know, wanted to get in the Guinness Book of World Records. People do somehow things. Yes.
Most fish up my penis record. That's
yeah, not a lot of competition for that one.
No, not so much.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
We've got a podcast recommendation I think will be really fun and or useful for Monster Talk listeners. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast.
Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world of today. For example, migration patterns of dinosaur lineages can tell us about the Earth's changing continents.
Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming.
Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution.
Talk about paleo. In many dinosaur injuries, paleopathologies are the first known occurrences of diseases.
A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That is just so interesting, though, because I do think a lot of people have accepted that that story is true and that this is a real thing. So this is myth-busting here.
Yeah, well, maybe.
I mean, the Amazon is a vast, vast place, and there are lots of people living in the Amazon, lots of people living near the water who grew up around the water and swim in the water every day and often don't wear clothes.
Yeah.
And this... this doesn't happen.
Right. I mean, it's not an endemic problem. Yeah.
And so, you know, the millions of person days in water contact and then the ubiquity of these catfishes. I mean, they're quite common. They're widespread throughout the Amazonian lowlands. They're not rare. In habitats like this on a beach, you can catch dozens to even hundreds of these in certain habitats. So, you know, there's regular opportunity for this to occur, and it doesn't occur. It just doesn't.
That's the other thing. The fish itself, you've seen it. It seems, I mean, I don't know how large this man's penis is, but it seems larger than a urethra would normally be.
So we get into the second dubious aspect of the story. Yeah, if you want to go to the video of Jeremy Wade holding this at ENPA on YouTube,
I'll have a link in the show notes. Yep.
you can see it in Jeremy Wade's hand, and Jeremy Wade has, you know, a good sized hand. He's a you know, tall gentleman and has large hands, and this fish stretches all the way across his hand basically, and it's almost a centimeter wide head. So swimming up the urine stream, these things don't have, they're not the best swimmers in that kind of setting, and then the width of the head would not fit within what you might think of as the average size of a urethra. And then the physician involved said that he went in and clipped those odontodes that I mentioned that can be averted from the side of the head and lodges these things into tight cavities. He says with his endoscope, he went in and clipped those odontodes. Well, the specimen has the odontodes intact. There's nothing clipped off the side of the head. That didn't happen. If this is the fish, you know, who knows, you know, where do you draw the line on what might have happened, what did happen, etc.
Wow. I'm very excited. We're talking about this. This is great. And of course, there is the question, I mean, you know, did a fish swim into your penis is a different question than can a fish fit into your penis? That it, those are two different questions. Yes. But indeed. But as you say, I've seen the video, and it did seem like there was a lot of room in that cavity where the camera was working. And I find it hard to believe that was inside a human being. Yeah, yeah.
Well, who knows? Maybe the variable there is Silvio's unusually large urethra.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. I mean, I don't know if he's willing to, you know, make a 3D model of the fish and see if the model will fit into his penis. I mean, there's science could apply some techniques here.
Someone.
That is fascinating. To follow up on that, though, do we have any? I mean, I know there were some 19th century stories of these fish going into women's vaginas. And I think I saw one about an anus invasion. But do we know if there's anything to those? I mean, lots of women swim naked in the Amazon area as well. Do they report this problem?
That's a little bit harder. I mean, I would be more willing to accept that. I mean, you know, if a fish these fish do seek cavities and crevices
and blood,
and they will even as tight as, you know, if you try to hold your hand, your fingers as tight together as possible, and these fishes will be able to find a way in between your fingers and wedge themselves through. So they do seek out tight cavities, and they do try to swim into you know, as tight places. That's just part of their life history. And so, yeah, I mean, if you can imagine them finding their way into a vagina much more easily, or even an anus for that matter, than the end of a penis, rather. So that could be conceivable, but at the same time, you know, I don't go around the Amazon asking indigenous women if they've had anything swim into their vagina recently. So I don't have any data.
Some ethical issues there. Yeah,
get on that grant proposal now. Beat the rush.
But that is interesting that there aren't any stories like there are of men.
Yeah, I think men are more likely to either inflate stories like this or certainly to perpetuate stories like this than women. Maybe that's just an aspect of testosterone. I don't know.
This story is teetering on the edge of busted as far as myths go. I don't want to, like, you know, I don't know what Silvio's story is exactly in real life, but this seems very suspect. So, and I'm glad you're bringing these points. If it were a trial at this point, I would not find the Candiru guilty.
let it off.
But let's talk about, I mean, these fish are adapted to a vampiric lifestyle, a parasitic lifestyle. What in a normal course of life, what would these fish actually be doing? What's their behavior like? What do they normally eat?
I guess go back to one of the doubtful aspects of the story. So the doctor suggests that this fish had quote unquote chewed its way through the wall of the urethra, which is a very thick tissue, into the patient's scrotum. So at least beyond the At least in the shaft of the penis, the urethra has a very thick wall. If you go up into the body, then the wall gets very, very thin. But at any rate, this is a major injury if you penetrate the wall of the urethra. And speaking to the anatomy of these things, they just don't have this particular genus, at least Vandalia, does not have the teeth to chew like that. You know, they have these vampire-like teeth that are good at you know, penetrating and causing blood to flow, but not really chewing. They do have, so those are the oral teeth, or at least the mandibular teeth, the lower jaw teeth. In total, they have 9 clusters of teeth around the head. This is one of the really bizarre features of these fishes. And then their upper jaw teeth, the premaxillary teeth, are positioned more laterally on the kind of the corners of the skull, the corners of the head, and they're claw like. So they're almost scalpel like. And there's a larger genus of these kangaroos, an undescribed genus, actually a genus that I'm working with some Brazilian colleagues on describing. And this genus, we have video of them moving their head back and forth and actually opening a cavity, actually opening a hole in the side of another catfish. And that's using these lateral teeth on the sides of the head. But the Vandalia genus, no one's ever observed that happening in that genus. But that, you know, that just speaks to the ecological diversity of these groups. The kangaroo kind of group is very broad, very diverse, and more than just this Vandalia. And there are some very small ones. There's a genus called Paracanthopoma that has a very robust head, and it actually excavates little holes in the surface of big catfishes and hitches rides. We think it moves across the Amazon by hitching rides on big catfishes, and then occasionally maybe swims into the gills to have a blood meal. That's what most of these do. At least the blood feeding group, the Vandalinae, they ingest blood. They feed into gill cavities where blood is easily accessible, available, and can open open arteries with these distinctive teeth, and then with the teeth that are outside the head, erect those teeth, lodge themselves in place long enough to have a blood meal, and then leave, drop off, go into the sand. I usually find them on beaches, drawing a big net across the beach. You'll get, in some cases, you know, a few dozen of these in a 30-foot net.
So I am wondering, Nathan, how common are these fish?
They're pretty common. I mean, especially in big sandy beaches and big river channel habitats in the Essequibo, in the Amazon, throughout the Orinoco, they can be, you know, again, you might collect a few dozen on a beach with a, you know, they're usually up on beaches at night, and then they're often there resting from having a blood meal, so their guts may be very distended and bloated, full of blood. And as soon as you handle them, that blood is leaking out of them from their mouth and their anus, and you get blood all over your hands.
Well, it's just after Thanksgiving here, so I'm familiar with that feeling. But I mean, here we were stuffed with turkey, not blood, but gorged is gorged, right? But
yeah. You just feel like a kangaroo after your turkey. Again, the diversity of these things is remarkable, and there are some very small ones that are just, say, 3 or 4 centimeters long. Some of the Vandalia, like the one that is reported to have entered this man's urethra, is, I would say, 13 centimeters long, around there. And then the biggest one, it's an undescribed species, actually. I'm holding a jar with one in my hand. It's a good centimeter wide and maybe 20 centimeters long around there.
I know there's a lot of misinformation about this fish on the internet. I mean, there's so many YouTube videos that claim to be telling the true story and aren't. And I saw one today that because I think some people now call them the penis fish. And so they were showing a video. It was like, learn about the penis fish. And what they were actually showing was Cesalians, if I'm pronouncing that right. The big, they do look like penises. That's true.
Cesalians are amphibians. There are a lot of eel-like organisms out there. Cesalians are one, and lots of different fishes that are eel-like, but not eels. all of these candirus are very elongate and eel-like.
Yeah, but much smaller, it looks like, the candiru. I mean, of course, I don't actually know how big the Cesalians are.
But a foot long or so.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I did want to – I had a question for you, which is one hypothesis – about the legend would be that the fish are attracted to urine. Do you know if there's been any formal testing on that to see?
Yeah,
if that's...
some people have delved into that, and there's no evidence really that they're attracted to urine. And the idea behind that is that they specialize on blood feeding from gills of fishes, and fishes excrete urea and nitrogen waste via their gills, in part, at least, via their gills. And so there was this belief that maybe they're finding their way into gills by following that odorant, chemical trail leading into gill cavities. But the limited testing that's been done, there have been a few experiments, hasn't supported that hypothesis. So.
Well, it still, even knowing that the candiru probably don't swim into penises or probably vaginas, it still feels like it would be wise to wear swimming trunks when you're in Amazonian rivers or in the Brazilian rivers. Does that seem sound?
Whatever makes you feel better. I mean, I really don't think you're at any risk of a candiru attack. In the Amazon. Again, you know, I've done about 24 trips down to the Amazon, a few weeks each, and collected a lot of these, swam around these, and never felt threatened or at risk, nor did anyone around me who had lived in those settings and grown up in those settings.
That's very comforting.
Can't see you doing that anyway, but.
Well, that's also true.
there's really only one fish in the Amazon that people are universally and genuinely afraid of, and that's stingrays. People watch where they step.
Oh,
definitely. Yeah,
that was not what I thought you were going to say. Okay, what? Well, I thought he was going to say that people are universally scared of piranha, but we've already debunked that in a previous episode.
Yeah.
The electric eel, I mean, if you're in the right habitat where there are electric eels, you know, they're worthy of respect. Usually you get a little bit of a warning, a little bit of a tingling sensation, and you know to back up.
Wow. Okay.
But the electric eel, you know, or rather the stingrays, when you step on a stingray and if you get nailed by a stingray, then it's pretty bad news, you know.
So is it worse than just the piercing wound? Is there like a venom involved?
There's a venom involved, and there's a high likelihood of infection. So if you're not treated, frequently these wounds get infected, and without treatment, lead to the loss of a foot, or severe damage, necrosis of the calf.
Yikes!
Well, Nathan, this has been a fascinating conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about catfish or kangaroo, just any other interesting tidbits about them?
We really don't know. You know, these catfishes, they're blood feeders. They're not the only blood-feeding organisms out there. Of course, there are vampire bats. There are mosquitoes. Lawyers.
Yeah. Yep.
In most of these, there are special chemicals that prevent the coagulation of blood, and that's advantageous because if you've ingested a big blood meal, you don't want it turning solid, you know, in your gut, and even less so if you're a fish and you're trying to move, maintain flexibility of your body, and you've got this big bloated stomach. And so it seems likely that that these catfishes have some form of anticoagulant. But to my knowledge, no one's looked at it yet. And it's kind of an exciting possibility. It's something I'm starting to look into to see if there's any genomic indication of anticoagulant proteins or enzymes in the gut. So that, you know, there may even be a medical application for these fish.
Yeah, that'd be
cool.
That
is interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, my God, this was an efficient interview. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So informative and
yeah. I mean, this
surprising.
And the culmination of a decade trying to get someone to come talk to us about this. This is so great. I really appreciate it.
One other thing I was going to mention, too, and I've got a video that that shows this. If, you know, you can describe it or you can post it to your webpage. I don't really care. But the Vandalia you can hold in your hand without problem, without, you know, them. They might leak blood on you, but they're not going to draw blood from your hand. Their teeth, again, are not big enough to even pierce the skin on your hand. But this undescribed genus we're working on that seems to be restricted to the main channel of the Amazon and feeds probably exclusively on really big prey items, big catfishes, maybe even freshwater dolphins. They have a much more serious and formidable bite. And I was handling a species that we're going to put in this genus now called Plectrochilus diabolicus. They're in the Western Amazon. I was collecting them in Ecuador and handling these things. They immediately draw blood. They have a more formidable jaw system that that allows them to penetrate, you know, the skin on your hand. And in many respects are much more impressive and fearsome than the Vandalia that people that legend says is, you know, more scary and poses greater risk. But this undescribed genus that is really, there are very few of these in collections, and they're rarely encountered because they're in the main channel of the Amazon. They're a much scarier beast, and I'm really looking forward to describing this new genus with Mario De Penna from the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil.
You have to come back on the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some more.
Yeah. And it also sounds like, you know, ichthyology is a field where there's plenty left to be discovered if you want to name some things. That's so cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that brings us to our closer question. I hope you've had a little chance to think about this. We'd like to ask all our first-time guests, what's your favorite monster?
Man, it's got to be the alien from Aliens. Just the biology behind that. The movies were amazing. They really stoked my imagination growing up, watching Aliens first and then going back and watching the original. But amazing cinematic creatures and then, you know, the whole ant and hive, the queen, the biology behind these, I thought was really fascinating. So, definitely the alien.
That's so funny because during the interview, when you were describing the jaws on the kangaroo, I told Kieran in our private chat over here that I thought, this is totally reminding me of the xenomorphs from Aliens. So that's really funny.
He did, yeah. Can understand the fascination.
There are some fishes, particularly eels, that all fishes have throat jaws. These jaws that are back in the throat, they're called pharyngeal jaws. That's one of the distinctive features of fishes generally. They capture food with their oral jaws, the mouth, and then they process food with their throat jaws, the pharyngeal jaws. Well, there are some eels that can actually project those throat jaws into the mouth and take those food items back into the throat, very much like the xenomorph.
Yeah, I've always been curious about the goblin shark, too. I wasn't sure what was going on with that exactly.
Yeah.
But it certainly looks like something from a space movie, and less like something that I ever want to see in real life, you know.
Yeah. Not a lot of fodder here for new shows.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us. It's really hard to state how much I appreciate this.
Thank you, Nathan.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for your time, Nathan. Have a good night.
Yes, you're indeed. Welcome. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with ichthyologist Dr. Nathan Lujan discussing the candiroo of South America. This interview surprised me in so many ways. On the one hand, I knew I'd learn a bunch of new stuff about these very interesting blood-sucking catfish, but what I didn't expect was how well this story of Silvio Barbosa and the catfish that allegedly swam up his penis would fit with the kinds of stories we routinely hear about monsters. I mean, a blood-sucking catfish isn't a Bigfoot, but there's a lot to learn here. On the clip of the show from River Monsters, Silvio looks sincere and helpful. Jeremy Wade presents the story uncritically and very compellingly. And if you dig no further than this TV show, it would be very easy to leave with the strong impression that this is an absolutely true story. We've talked before about how Karen and I like to approach any strange tale with a presumption of sincerity on the part of the claimants, but with a toolbox of skepticism and critical thinking ready to be put into play when it's time to decide if we actually believe the story or not. Could a catfish, like the specimen alleged to have been removed from this man's urethra, actually fit inside a human penis? Maybe. It's unfortunately quite surprising what people have managed to insert into their penises, and I cannot emphasize this enough, I do not encourage you to go image searching on that. But could this little fish swim up a stream of urine and then lunge itself inside a penis while the victim was standing outside the water? I'm extraordinarily sure that the answer to that is a resounding no. People routinely urinate into the river, and out of the vast number of people who do this all the time, only this one man had the poor fortune to find himself with a fish invading him? And then there's the matter of the fish itself does not have the anatomical damage alleged by the surgeon who says he removed it. Given that he videotaped the internal process of the surgery, it seems strange to make a mistake about what was done to remove the fish, yet these parts that were allegedly damaged during the removal remain intact on the specimen in the jar. All in all, what we have here is a story told by people who seem sincere and certain, yet the evidence provided does not comport with or support the narratives they're giving. It's probably due to the incredibly litigious world that we live in, along with the social consequences of calling someone a liar, that few people call out such stories as lies. But what should we call it if not a lie? Implausible seems like a weak word. Impossible comes more to mind. Yet for some folks, just knowing that there are people who stick by their story, it's enough to make them believe. Did Silvio have a fish surgically removed from his penis? Maybe. Did a fish swim up a stream of urine and embed itself into his penis? Definitely not. What we have here is a bit of folklore about a real fish that can be used to scare outsiders and can be used by outsiders to mock locals. The legend that Stephen Fry told about that I shared during the introduction reveals another piece of the folklore. That all along the Amazon, men keep some twine handy so that they can put a knot around their penis before urinating into the river. It's a persistent legend, and used there as a joke, but it's a legend that really makes no sense if you give it more than a moment's thought. If they were going to risk penetration by a catfish when they tried to pee in the water, why would they not just go pee on shore or into a container? It's absurd. The candiroo is a fascinating fish. If you're another fish in the same water, it might even pose a threat to you. But like most parasites, it wants to use its host, not necessarily kill it. Overall, I think we can dismiss the risk that the candiroo poses of invading your private areas if you visit their territory with absolutely no strings attached.
Check out our Monster Talk merchandise at monstertalk.org/store, where you can find a variety of cool products to show that you're a next-level monster enthusiast.
Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as The Accidental Creative and The Sit Down. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you for making us a part of your listening life. We'll be right back.
This has been a Monster House presentation.
I don't think I'm the one in danger here, considering the sad fact that right below you flows the mighty Amazon, teeming with the most gruesome fish to ever...
The piranha?
No.
The shark?
No.
The piranha?
No! And shut up, this isn't a quiz. Now, where was I? Right. The dreaded candiru, a naughty little fish with a penchant for swimming up a man's urethra to feed on the damaged tissue of the pitiful mass of flesh you once called your penis!
That is a total myth. There is no such fish.
It's two.
No, there